Hey, thank you everyone for tuning in this weekend to Nevada Backcountry, proudly sponsored by Truck Envy Out West Buildings and now Legacy Sports International. They are based right here in Reno, Nevada. It's the Howa Rifles, Pointer Shotguns, Citadel Handguns. So we're extremely happy to have them on. Now, I'm not going to call it housekeeping this week, David, but news to report.
Just standard news.
Now, my wife has pointed out I say some things too often, so I'm going to call it standard news.
It's our catchphrases, man.
Yeah, I know.
It's a catchphrase.
I don't know if I'm cool enough to have a catchphrase. We'll call it, hey, it's housekeeping. Let's roll with that. Big news out of Wyoming. This just landed in my inbox. I wanted to talk briefly about maybe too much technology in the field nowadays. There is a ranch owner in Wyoming that is suing four hunters from Missouri for stepping over a corner of his property. Now, the hunters were using OnX, and this is where the technology comes in. So they were looking at a real zoomed-in view of private property parcels in this area of Wyoming. I guess there's a checkerboard of land. Hey, it's airspace. We're stepping over his property into public land. He is suing them for $7 million, and his lawyers have subpoenaed the OnX data. So they're going to be using that in court, basically showing, hey, this is where these guys were. The whole thing seems crazy to me. $7 million for stepping over a corner of someone's land. But that's a day and age in which we live.
Yeah, well, and the thing is, it's just not OnX. If you have a GPS with you, if you have your cell phone with you, those things, even without you pushing a button or pushing a track or doing whatever, that is still pinging the satellites and constantly keeping track of you. And, you know, once it's in the cloud or the wherever
yeah.
that is all stored in the mega files or the metadata,
the metaverse.
Yeah, it is. It can be subpoenaed. So it's kind of wild.
Weird.
It's kind of wild.
Yeah. And what happened to just, oh no, I didn't go on your property. Yeah, I don't know. Weird.
Or the whole thing of like, so what? You went across the corner of my property.
Yeah. They didn't harvest anything on his property. They just stepped over. I can't imagine the stress level.
I'm not sure where. How did they calculate $7 million?
Well, almost eight. It's $7.75 million.
How do they calculate that? Is there some algorithm like, okay, for X amount of steps across my property is equivalent to this times pi divided by the circumference of the earth or something?
Right. I don't know.
My God.
So I could not imagine finding myself potentially on the hook for almost $8 million. And this is the thing, not even stepping foot on the property, stepping over it. They entered his airspace or something. I mean, it's madness, just madness. So on to better things.
On to more exciting things.
Okay. Yeah. So
I guess
we'll see how that shakes out. We'll keep an eye on it and let you guys know.
See how that all pans out. But the next cool thing we're going to talk about, we had some viewers ask us a few questions about eligibility.
Yes.
So we've got some folks that are long-term outdoors people, and they were asking some questions about tags, and they were talking about, you know, I get to put in this year for elk, that they thought since they didn't harvest that they only had to wait the 5-year term.
Because it used to be 10 and 5.
It used to be 10 and 5. Right. 10 if you harvested, 5 if you didn't. Well, it's now 7 and 7, correct?
Yeah, 7 and 7. So regardless of whether or not you were successful or unsuccessful, it's 7 and 7. And again, that some of these things happen. This happened a little while ago, but it's just not on people's radar.
Yeah. Just curious, just your point of view, because I've got my own, is why do you think they went from a 7 or a 10 harvest, 5 not harvest waiting period to a no matter what 7 and 7? I got my view. What's yours?
Okay, before you go, yours is probably more measured and well-informed than mine. I would say it's a success rate thing. They wanted to see more elk taken out of certain areas. And back when it was 10 and 5, the incentive was there to, you know, hold off, to not take a satellite bull, to wait, take a herd bull. So guys would, you know, they might call in some raghorns, some satellite bulls, and then say, yeah, I only have to wait 5 years if I don't take one of these. I saw that 380 herd bull. That's the one I want. I'll eat tag soup. I'm okay with it. Now, it basically incentivizes, if you draw that bull tag, you know, kill something. Take an elk out of the herd. That's my thought on it. What's yours?
That you're pretty much spot on for what I was thinking too.
Oh,
I was,
okay, cool.
You know, because that was kind of how it seemed to me, was individuals that decided not to harvest because, well, they had that same thought of like, well, I only have to wait 5 and then I can start putting in again and then I can get my big monster bull I want. So they wouldn't harvest. And
right.
So exactly, success numbers would be down. And then one of the bigger issues in my mind was that they were now leaving. We were harvesting more big bulls, taking that genetics out of the system.
Oh, that makes sense.
And leaving all of the smaller bulls with less desirable
genetics
per se. You know, the raghorns, the small 5x5s, and, you know, the smaller bulls that people are like, yeah, I'm not going to shoot a 300. I'm not shooting a 330, even though, in my opinion, a 330 is a pretty smoking bull. But, you know, Nevada's well known for the 380s to low 400s. You know, what, a 407 or so was taken last year. So,
right.
Yeah, you're right. So now the individual will go out in the field and be like, oh, no matter what, it's 7 years. So I'm going to put some meat in the freezer and I'm going to pop this 5x5.
Yeah. And I don't think that's a bad thing.
No, I don't think so at all. I mean, it keeps that diversity within these herds, you know? So we are mixing it up. So
well, right, we're cool. On the same page. Yeah. Good.
All right. That's good.
Archery news. There were some date changes and
yes.
One I'm excited about. Definitely.
Yeah. Me too, because you and I were not going to be able to make that shoot because we're in Reading right now.
Right.
Just so you know, we've previously recorded this show because right now we are shooting in Reading.
In Reading, yeah.
Reading, California. But yeah, so we have some archery news coming up here. The Elko Archery Club has pushed the Snowbowl Challenge shoot back because of, obviously, there's way too much snow up there, mud, and a lot of runoff. So they've changed the date to be July 15th and 16th weekend of this year, 2023. And then they've also had to move the Bowhunter Classic, which will be held lower on the mountain. It'll be held at the Spring Creek Shooting Facility this year because of the same reasons, a lot of snow, a lot of mud, a lot of runoff. But it'll still be held on June 3rd and 4th.
Okay.
So those are the two big changes. Snow Bowl has now been changed to July 15th and 16th, and the Bowhunter Challenge is still the same weekend, but it's just going to be down into the Spring Creek Shooting Facility. We've got the Fallon River Madness shoot coming up here May 20th and the 21st. They have added a really cool event Saturday night. We would prefer not having this particular event because it's for a very good, well-known archer, an archery family that has been hit with an illness. They are fighting some cancer, and they are piling up on medical expenses. So the Fallon Bowhunters are having a dinner Saturday night. It's a steak dinner, $20, which is an awesome price for a steak dinner. And all of the proceeds, 100% of the proceeds, will be donated to the Biggs family for their medical expenses. It is a fantastic fundraiser.
It's finally that time of year again. I don't know about you, but my family and I are ready to hit the open road. Do a little shed hunting, maybe some rock hounding, even a little scouting. Before I head for the outback of Nevada, I make sure my rig is as equipped as possible with accessories from Truck Envy. Andy and the guys at Truck Envy know just how hard the Big Empty can be on off-road vehicles, and they don't sell anything they wouldn't trust on their personal overlanding and off-road rigs. All right, guns, boomsticks, firearms, whatever you want to call them, that's what we're talking about for the rest of the show here. Back to the new show sponsor, I'm happy to have Legacy Sports International stepping up and sponsoring the show. I was over at their warehousing facility the other day, and I got to play with their new super light rifles. This thing, it feels like a toy. It's 4.5 pounds. It's got a carbon fiber stock. They have one that has a carbon fiber barrel, one that has your traditional steel barrel, but both of these things were just stupid light. And I thought, man, this is a perfect backcountry rifle. They've only got a handful of calibers they're doing it in right now. The one that I was kind of excited about coming up here soon, they're going to be releasing the 243 Winchester chambering in that super light rifle. Now, that leads us into choosing a rifle. David, what are your thoughts on how to pick a rifle?
Well, first off, I try to figure out who I'm choosing it for. Is it for myself? Is it for a youth or a smaller framed person, you know, that may want to get into shooting? And then what are the target animals that we will be using that particular gun for? For like my kids, when I started looking for a rifle for when they started youth hunting, I only looked at pretty much the smaller stuff, the 243, the 25-06, and the 257 were my three go-tos that, you know, friends and relatives and hunters had said, hey, those are great kid guns. Or not kid, but, you know, youth.
And I would agree. Those are three classic, light recoiling, fast, accurate rounds.
Yeah, and, you know, going through some of the internet and the magazines, the five that they stated were probably some of the best small or medium game animal rifles for like deer, antelope, pigs, things like that.
Yeah.
They said it was the 243, the 25-06, the 257, the 6.5 Creedmoor and PRC, and then a 28 Nosler. I'm not really familiar with a 28 Nosler.
Yeah, I would, I don't want to be too aggressive on this, but the 28 Nosler, for those that don't know, go take a look at it. It's a 7 REM mag on steroids, and I personally, I have a 7 mag. I've killed stuff in Africa with a 7 mag, and I will tell you, that is a filling rattler. So, whoever wrote that article, 28 Nosler, that is a stupid fast barrel-burning caliber. So I agreed with him up until that.
That would be more of like a big game caliber type of a thing.
Yes, yeah.
Maybe I read that article wrong, but they were talking about a 28 Nosler. I'm like, okay, I'm not really sure what that is. But
everything else on there is great. Yeah. That one, though, is a head-scratcher.
Well, some of the stuff I was reading about, because I'm more familiar with archery than rifles, for sure. That's where you come in. They're saying the medium-sized game deer antelope is anything like a 270 or smaller. Anything up to like a 270 is a solid choice.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
But then there's not a lot of folks can afford to have a gun for each game species. So, like, what would be a good all-around, if you had to buy one gun to go from antelope to elk?
Antelope to elk, I would look at like a 6.5 PRC. I like, you get into bullet design and stuff, and I think with newer modern bullets that hold together better at faster velocities, I think a 6.5 PRC is a good elk gun. I think it's a light recoiling caliber. Now, that said, let me preface all of this with, I've heard all the stories. I know that somebody out there right now is like, hey, my great uncle Ed killed 150 elk with nothing more than a 22 Win Mag. Yeah, I get that. I've seen elk die from being shot with a 25-06. I've also seen elk run off after getting hit with a 300 Win Mag. Shot placement is crucial, but for antelope to elk out west here, I'm looking at something like a 6.5 PRC.
Like when I was looking at guns, besides the caliber, I then took into play the amount of money it costs for a box of shells.
And that if you don't reload, that is 100% something to take into account for sure.
Yeah. 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 Cause you know, when you acquire a gun, what you should do yearly is go out and you shoot it a bunch.
Yeah.
You know, make sure and have some good times with it. Just don't leave it in the safe and go, well, I'll see you when I get a tag. You know, get out there and shoot it. But yeah. So me personally, when I decided to purchase a rifle, a one and done kind of a rifle, something I can use for anything
in Nevada,
that I may get a tag for, I was debating between a 30-06 and a 308. And I ended up going with the 308. One reason, I really liked the feel of the gun that I was testing, which was a Hawa.
Hey, good.
So a 308 Hawa. I really liked it. And the boxes of shells were right at my price point.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't want to spend $80 a box.
No.
When I didn't have to.
No, and you can buy bulk 308 stuff for cheap if you just want to go out and shoot. You did well. That's a phenomenal cartridge. Back to your point when I brought up in Nevada.
Yeah.
And that's one thing, you know, we get so hyper-focused on hunters looking at, okay, what caliber do I want for this species I am hunting? A big component as well outside of the state of Nevada is what other species are in the area. And I'll use a real life example. I've got a couple 6.5 Creedmoors. They're both super accurate guns. You know, I'd have no problem taking that on a black bear hunt. Going up into northern Idaho, places in Montana, some parts of Wyoming, you have to realize you're going into grizzly country. And part of that is knowing, okay, you know, if I do come across a grizzly, I get charged. Would I bet my life on this caliber? So for me, it's also that thing, okay, where am I hunting? What else is in the area? So like for this Idaho hunt, I know you put me on the spot to get it done with a Satori. I still might do that, but I also might throw my 7 mag in the truck to head up just for the simple fact that the area we're going to be hunting, my brother works in the medical field. And just recently had a patient that was charged by a grizzly in that same exact area. So there are grizzlies there. And, you know, I love the Creedmoor, but I don't know that I'd bet my life on it.
Yeah, you don't trust it to put a grizzly down.
No, I don't. Quickly. Yeah, quickly is the key there. So that's something to take into consideration as well. If you're hunting outside of the state of Nevada, you're hunting in grizzly country, you might want to bring something slightly bigger.
Yeah. Now, what would you think would be a good gun for a kid?
Oh, 243. Oh, 243. Yeah, I like the 243. Any of those 6mm cartridges, you know, we were going to talk about 1, 2, 3. How many is too many when it comes to guns? I think for the lower 48, there's my caveat to this. Something in a 6mm bullet, like a 243 or a 6 Creedmoor, which arguably does what the 6.5 Creedmoor is supposed to do and does it better, but something in that 6mm for like a youth or a varmint, a predator gun, antelope, even deer, with something like a Nosler partition or a bonded core type bullet, that would be a good round. And then honestly, you only need one more gun, and that would be if you were going up into Montana, Wyoming, northern Idaho. And then I would look at something in like a 30 caliber, maybe some of the faster, harder hitting sevens. But honestly, you could hunt everything in the lower 48 with like a 30 caliber and a 6mm or a 243 caliber.
Yeah.
Two and done.
Two and done. I got a buddy. He shoots everything with a 7mm mag.
Yeah, that's kind of
that is his meat and potatoes, man. Just loves that 7mm mag.
It's a phenomenal cartridge. Like I said, I hunted in Africa with one. I used other guns as well, but I've seen the results. I'm comfortable with it in grizzly country. You know, once you get outside of the lower 48, Like if you're talking about a Fognak Island up in Alaska, you're dealing right. with 10, 11 foot bears.
Yeah.
You know, I'm probably going to start leaning towards like the 375 or like a 338 Win Mag. But lower 48, yeah, a 7mm, if you can handle the recoil, that could be a one-and-done gun for yeah. sure.
Okay.
But I would not put that in the hands of a youth shooter.
Yeah, a youth shooter. I mean, that'll deter them pretty quick. And we're back. Thank you again for joining us this Sunday for another episode of Nevada Backcountry. Right now, we're going to get into some big game calibers and maybe get into a little bit of conversation on some scopes.
So when it comes to big game stuff, there's been this trend, and this is where we need the Armstrong and Getty Gladys with the harp going down yes. memory lane.
Yes.
Let's hit the rewind.
Man, that's not
perfect.
Good. That's
I know it's good.
Was that good? Was it?
One more time. Perfect. There I am.
Nice.
1947, John Nosler comes up with the partition. So for those unfamiliar, the Nosler partition bullet, the rear half of the bullet is actually an encapsulated lead chunk. So prior to this, bullets had been pretty thin-skinned. They weren't necessarily, the copper jacket wasn't bonded to the core. So a larger caliber made sense because people were worried about bullets blowing up on the thick hide of an animal or
yeah.
not fully penetrating. So 1947, he comes up, John Nosler comes up with the partition. Then shortly thereafter, I think they went into production in like 48. Then P.O. Ackley's famous book comes out, which of course I'm going to draw a blank on the name. But he starts experimenting in the 50s and 60s with bullet design, getting faster velocities. And fun fact, he actually tested all of his theories on, it was like wild mules or something in Arizona and New Mexico.
Oh, wow.
Back in the 50s, you could just go out and shoot.
Yeah, just take care of business,
I guess.
Yeah.
It was like, hey, I think this is a good bullet design. Let me go whack a few wild mules and figure out. Or whatever they were. It's like donkeys or something.
Burros.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, he liked those because they had a real thick, tough hide. So he starts experimenting with that. And that brings us to modern bullets, modern velocities, modern powders, all that stuff.
So this is just basically this technology is being able to figure out how to keep the bullet together.
100%.
After contact.
Yep, after impact. So now, after that, you start to see in the 70s and 80s this trend towards lighter calibers. And I shared with you, I actually shot a Bison with my 25-06. I won't go into why I wound up doing that, but
I know.
Somebody I was hunting with forgot the ammo for a bigger caliber gun, but it performed well. Modern bullets are surprisingly robust. They'll penetrate fine. So people started realizing, hey, man, you know, maybe I don't need a 338 Win Mag to kill deer.
Right, yeah, I'd have to take my shoulder off. I mean,
yeah,
I shot a buddy's grandfather's 10-gauge shotgun
once.
Once, and that was it.
And there's, you know, there's the science behind recoil. We won't go into all of that, but, you know, some of those, like a 375 H&H, yeah, it's a bigger caliber, a lot more powder being burned, but it's like a push. Versus, I'll go back to last segment in the 7 mag, that's like a sharp, again, I'll use that like filling rattler for some reason, versus like a 375. So there is some science behind the shoulder of the cartridge and all that.
Well, and even just that, just the design and the structure of the stocks these days
that,
that absorb a lot of this recoil.
That old walnut stock with a metal plate.
I mean, it might look really cool, and it might be the coolest looking deal. But you put that brass plate on your shoulder, and from that 1960s rifle, and
in 30-06,
in a 30-06, and you're wondering why you can't shoot anything for the next 3 weeks because your shoulder's black and blue.
Now, fast forwarding to picking a big game caliber. I'm partial to the sevens. Again, for if you're a lower 48 guy like me, anything in the sevens is going to be a good, and by that I mean 0.284 inches or a 7mm. So 7 rem mag, 280 Ackley improved. That's one of my dad's absolute favorites. Even the 7mm 08, that might be a little light, but you're still throwing a pretty heavy projectile, and I don't think you could go wrong with any of those.
No, probably not. When it comes to that kind of stuff, I guess I always track away from all these newer calibers, with the fancy numbers and everything. But I like sticking to the old faithfuls. The old faithfuls, the 30-06, the 308, the 300, those. That's to me, it just screams reliability. And you can go into literally any bait, tackle, and burger shop.
Bingo.
And say, hey, man, I fell in the water and soaked all my bullets. You got any 30-06s? And they're gonna pull them out by the case.
Yep.
You walk in there and say, yeah, I need a 7mm-08. And they're going to go,
what? Yeah.
So.
7 rem mag, 30-06. Yeah. You can find it everywhere.
Exactly. 270.
Dillon, Montana, there's a gas station right when you get into town there. Yeah, you look at the shelves, and that's what you're going to see. You're going to see 270, you're going to see 7 rem mag, you're going to see 30-06, maybe some of the 338 Win Mag stuff. But there's, like you said, there's that availability of ammo versus something like a 7 PRC,
right,
which I forget about finding ammo for that thing.
Well, and plus in Montana, don't they give you a box of shells when you cross the border?
Yeah, I think so.
I think it's kind of like a crossing thing. Yeah, they just hand you a box.
Yeah, so that's where I come down. I do think something like a 7mm ought 8. It's a 7mm bullet, and it recoils so much less that I think something like that might be a viable option for a smaller framed shooter. So some of these newer things like the 6.5 Creedmoor and all that, 6.5 PRC, they've got that dialed now where you can throw a heavy bullet, a modern bullet, great penetration, especially for big game animals, and they don't recoil that much. So like for my wife, she shoots a 308. There's a good one. All a 7mm ought 8 is a 308 case, neck down to 7. So that's another one, Dave, that I think is a good option for an elk rifle even.
Yeah, that's what my wife shoots is a 308. She loves that gun. So basically with modern technology, not only with guns and stocks, but primarily with the bullets, it's allowing smaller framed folks to actually pick up a larger caliber rifle and hunt bigger game, at least feel more comfortable getting that game on the ground.
Yeah, and we could talk, let's talk about that real quick. This goes back to the P.O. Ackley studies and the velocity, hydrostatic shock inside of an animal's body cavity. And we've all heard the stories. Somebody says, well, I swear by this because it's like a bolt of lightning hit them, the dead right their gun or dead right their caliber.
Yeah.
So they've done studies on this stuff, and basically the science I've read on this whole dead right there thing, one, everybody knows placement is paramount.
Yeah.
So, if you got a gut shot elk with a 300 is going to go just as far as a gut shot elk with a 22.
Yeah.
Placement, put it where you're supposed to put it. But then what they have found is essentially if you hit an animal right after they exhale, there's no air in their lungs, and you hit them a good shot in the vitals, it immediately shuts down their nervous system. And that's the old, hey, hit by a lightning bolt, dropped right there. If the animal has inhaled and now they have oxygenated blood flowing through their system, even if it's a great shot, you blow up the heart, you punch both lungs, they can still run 60, 70 yards before keeling over.
Yeah.
I don't think that there's...
It's just timing.
It's timing. And yeah. I don't know about you, but if I'm looking through a scope at an elk 400 yards away, I'm not timing the breath. I'm putting it in the boilerplate, period.
Right. Yeah. So when you go back to people are doing this with a bow and arrow all the time. I mean, even recurves and longbows, and you put the arrow in the right spot.
It'll die.
It does the trick.
Yeah, it might run. My deer last year, center punched it, perfect shot, still ran probably 100 yards at full sprint before it keeled over dead. So as long as you ventilate the lungs, it will go down eventually, but... Back to the big game cartridge thing, I don't know that there is a true this caliber or this cartridge kills better than this cartridge. I'd say your margin for error is greater when you have a larger caliber. You know, if you happen to clip that shoulder or something like on a big mature, a bull elk, 300 Win Mag probably buys you a little bit more insurance than a 25-06, we'll say. And we can touch on that in the next segment when we come back on Nevada Backcountry, brought to you by Out West Buildings, Truck Envy, and Legacy Sports International. Wrapping it up here on Nevada Backcountry, we're going to talk a little bit about zeroing distances. Coming off that last segment, starting to get into some of the velocity questions, and you know, it brings up a very good point. What distance do you zero your rifles at? I've kind of got my thing, which of course is going to be long, meandering, and convoluted. So, David, give me the simple answer. What do you zero your hunting rifles at?
You're just assuming that I'm going total simple right now?
I'm hoping.
I'm not. What?
Go for it.
Well, so when I started getting into the rifles because of the kids, I just, with the 243 for the kids, I was like, I'm going to zero in at 100 because I'm not expecting them to shoot any further than 200.
Right.
You know, they're 12, 13, 14 years old. I'm going to keep it tight. So that's what we did. We zeroed in at 100.
Now, did you do the inch and a half high at 100, or did you do dead on?
I went dead on at 100. Then when we got the 308 and the wife was hunting with the antelope and deer, we bumped it up. I zeroed it at 150, and we zeroed it a little high at 150.
Okay.
So that if we went to 2, 2.25, because she ended up harvesting her antelope just at 200 yards.
Okay.
And she just laid it right on there, and she took care of business and didn't have to make any adjustments. So, and that's just because that's the things I've read about and talked to folks like you and people that hunt with a rifle. So that's kind of where my sweet spot is, I guess, is about 150 I like to zero it in on. I'm thinking if I end up with a rifle for myself, I will probably go and zero it in at 200.
Yep. Okay.
Is what I'm going to do. I wouldn't mind if I had to reaching out to 300 or 400 yards. 400 would probably be my max yardage I would ever shoot, and it would have to be like fantastic conditions.
The perfect shot.
Yeah, because that's just me. You know, I'm sure you probably shoot a lot further distance. I've got friends that have taken elk at 500 and 600 yards. I've been on their hunts, and to me, that's like, oh my God.
That thing's out there.
That's out there.
Yeah.
You know, but they practice with their rifles like I practice with my bow, so it makes sense.
Well, I will tell you, you might be shocked at this. I took a really long shot at an elk, and this is after years of shooting long range in the military, being neurotic about all this stuff. When you start getting out past 600, 700 yards, man, shooting across canyons, the wind calls are funky, the wind at the target might be different. When you're shooting on a range, you know, you have your windicator flags downrange. You can kind of know what the wind's doing. When you're in the woods and, you know, mine, I'll admit it on air, I lost an elk in Montana, a bull. I took a long shot across a canyon and made a horrendous wind call. Where we were on the side of the finger, I guessed it at maybe 5 gusting up to 10 miles an hour. Well, I made my shot, hit way back, and realized, oh, something went wrong there. Well, as soon as we started hiking over to where the bull was when I shot it, you came around this finger and the wind was 3 times what I was feeling where we were at.
Oh, gotcha.
And that experience just made me realize, man, there's, you know, nature always gets a vote. And I just made a horrible wind call. And I just realized, I went back to that, like, man, I don't need to be, if I can't get within 400, maybe 500 yards of something, I probably don't need to be shooting at it. Now, that said, I still like going out and ringing steel at 1,200, 1,300, 1,400 yards. I find that stuff enjoyable.
Yeah, but it's not an animal.
Right. I don't want to hunt like that.
Yeah. See, coming from an archery background, I don't understand why you have to shoot 400 or 500 yards. I stock up on everything, so I always feel like, yeah, I can get, without a doubt, I can get 100 yards from just about anything.
Right.
You know, because just from my years of doing it. So, but there's a lot of folks out there. I mean, there's a huge contingent that challenge themselves, and they won't shoot anything less than 750, 800 yards, because
that's what they want to do.
That's what they want to do. That's how they want to. Their challenge is harvesting an animal at long distances, like 1,200, 1,300 yards.
And you know what? Hey, if you put the work in.
Yeah.
And you're, you know, your own personal moral compass, and ethically you're good with it, then, you know, who am I to stand in judgment? I just know me personally, it ain't for me.
No. But,
so back to the zero thing.
Yeah.
Here's where I was going with all this. I'm a 200 guy, depending on the cartridge. Like a 25-06, I'm coming out of the barrel with a 117 grain bullet at about 3,100 feet per second. If I'm dead on at 200, I know pretty much put the crosshairs on the animal where I should on the vitals, pull the trigger out to about 350. I'm good. 400, maybe cheat 3-4 inches high on the animal. 450, put the crosshairs on the back of the animal, and I'm going to kill that thing. But that is a fast, flat shooting gun, and that's why
I like that. 25-06?
25-06, okay. Yep. With my load, with my bullet, 117 grain, Sierra Spire Point boat tail bullet. That's kind of what I figured out. And I can get away with just using a simple old school duplex reticle. And I kind of like hunting like that, where it's, you know, I'm not fiddling with dials. Again, there's a time and a place. I love going out to the range and fiddling with dials. Hunting, though, I kind of just like that, throw it up to my shoulder and shoot.
Yeah. So in a hunting situation, you know, when, like you said, when you're out at the range and you're just tinkering and you're having a good time with the windage and the elevation, and you're tinkering with all those components
knobs
that you spend a lot of money to say, I have another knob on my scope. In your opinion, do you really think you should be tinkering with all those knobs? Or is there any specific knob you feel, no matter what, when I got this gun zeroed in, this knob stays?
Don't ever touch your windage.
Windage?
Dial for elevation, hold for windage. There's too many issues there. And as much as we love to put faith in modern scopes and, you know, hey, I spent $3,500 on this US optics, blah, blah, blah. Hey, that's great. I just was always taught, once your gun is zeroed, don't touch the windage. Now, for long range shooting, you should be shooting something with some sort of windage indicator inside the reticle, be that like a Horace style Christmas tree, or I believe Leupold calls theirs a windplex or something like that. But I was always taught, dial for elevation, don't touch your windage.
Okay.
So that's my rule of thumb.
That's good advice.
And that brings us into these whole, I don't think there's anything wrong with dialing in the field. However, you brought up a story, a hunt with a friend who got out there, took a shot at an elk, and it was a chip shot and missed by feet or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep.
I've experienced it where luckily it wasn't at an animal, but got out there on a hunt. And like I always do, I thought, man, I better take a rip at 100, just make sure I'm still zeroed.
Yeah.
I was about 2 feet off. My scope had gotten knocked around, and it was not a bargain. It was an expensive flagship scope, but these things are not completely bomb-proof. Things go wrong. So one of the things we've talked about is doing a box test. I just had this conversation with somebody else. Once you pick the rifle you want, you pick the scope you want, everything's on there, you head out to the range to zero it. One of the first things I would do is draw a measured 1-inch by 1-inch box. And what you then do is zero on one corner of that box. And if you, most everybody kind of understands minute of angle, and all 90% of scopes, I'd say, are quarter minute of angle adjustments, which is approximately a quarter inch at 100 yards. So you zero on one corner of the box. You should be able to click your elevation knob 4 times to move it up an inch, and your bullets should now impact at that measured 1 inch next corner of the box. Then do the same thing with your windage. Click that sucker 4 times, move it right. Your bullets should now impact at that corner of the box. So on and so forth. That will tell you whether or not your scope is actually tracking. Don't find yourself in a situation where you go out and say, hey, I need 12 clicks on my elevation knob to hit this whatever at whatever distance. And you put in your 12 clicks and you're 3 feet off because your scope is not tracking correctly.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
So there, I told you it was going to be long, convoluted, and meandering.
Well, no, I mean, that all helps me because, you know, I want to get out and sight in the 308 a little bit better. I'm hoping that the wife or I end up with a antelope tag this year. So we got to do the box test.
Absolutely.
Got to hit the box first, though.
Nah, let's go out and shoot guns. You know, we spend a lot of time flinging arrows together, Dave. Let's spend some time pulling a trigger together, too.
Yeah, that'd be a blast.
On that note, thank you sincerely for tuning in this weekend. Thank you to Truck Envy, Out West Buildings, and Legacy Sports International for sponsoring the show. We will see you guys next week.